Welcome to DCEKG, where we diagnose Washington's policy issues and prescribe needed solutions. Join your hosts, Eric Ulland and Joe Grogan, along with leading in-the-room experts, as they shine a light on the black box of DC and break down healthcare issues and policy areas that shape healthcare.
Welcome back to DCEKG, where we diagnose DC's policy diseases and prescribe needed solutions. I'm Joe Grogan, and joining me as always is the great Eric Ulland. Today, we're diving into the realm of artificial intelligence and government reform, the potential of AI to revolutionize healthcare administration, and FDA's regulatory process. According to recent studies, administrative burden across healthcare programs like Medicaid has reached unprecedented levels, and doctors in particular suffer from a tremendous amount of paperwork burden. AI offers a glimmer of hope, promising to streamline processes and reduce inefficiencies. Our guest today is Dr. Brian Miller, a practicing hospitalist, which I want to hear him explain what it is, because when I was growing up, that didn't exist. He's an assistant professor of medicine and business at Johns Hopkins University and a non-resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, although he might as well be a resident considering how often he's there and how much work product he's cranking out these days. He's also the author of two recent opinion pieces that we're going to be discussing. One, an innovation-driven future for the Food and Drug Administration, and the other, using artificial intelligence to improve administrative processes in Medicaid. Brian, well, let's start right there. What is a hospitalist? Is some type of doctor? Is that what that is?
Yeah, I actually just finished a shift. A hospitalist is an internist who only sees patients in the hospital. So you see people who are coming in with everything from a drug overdose to pneumonia to kidney failure to a new diagnosis of cancer.
So, and of course, Johns Hopkins is not a small operation. Their hospital is pretty world renowned, and you're pretty well experienced in hospital in healthcare administration in the federal government as well. So, what was it about AI that got you thinking about it? Why did you get excited about AI and start to investigate and crank out some articles in this space?
15 years ago, I was in med school, and I quickly realized that medicine and the healthcare system thought it was special when it shouldn't be special. And it's not that science and clinical care aren't important, aren't special, they are, but that our administration is especially bad. So all the innovation and processes and automation that we've had in basically every other industry, think about, you know, going to the store or going to visit a friend. 20 years ago, someone gave you turn-by-turn directions on the phone. 15 years ago, you logged on to MapQuest and you printed out directions after you got the address from your friend and you were fumbling with papers while driving, swerving to narrowly avoid a mailbox. And then it got to the in-car navigation with the clunky touchscreens. And now, before you know it, you have Google Maps, which just gives you directions via Apple CarPlay through your car stereo. So that transformation has happened for almost every part of American life, except in healthcare.
And Brian, why is that? Why this slow take up in how technology can be used in healthcare?
So a couple things. One is overabundance of the precautionary principle, which is a bit understanding given the profession's ethos, right?
And so could you unpack that a little bit? I know we've talked about precautionary principle before, but if you could at least put a fine point on what that is. And then to your point, well, do no harm, how much it really impedes looking at and folding in technology to healthcare.
So it's basically about risk avoidance. And your concern is that new processes or new technology or new ways of doing things may in fact create risk and cause harm. And therefore, you know, the profession can be slower to adopt doing new things. The counterpoint of that people haven't realized is that the failure to adopt new ways of doing things and new processes may actually be causing harm in itself, because you're depriving patients and clinicians of better, more efficient, and safer ways to do things. So an example would be inserting a central line, which is like a very large IV. It goes in someone's neck, you use it to deliver certain medications for dialysis access. For 30, 40 years ago, if you did that, you used anatomical landmarks and stuck a big needle in someone's neck, and you could miss. Everyone's slightly different. Nowadays, you use ultrasound guidance to make sure, like, you actually visualize the vein, you put the needle in, and that's the standard of care. If, you know, 40 years ago you said, by the way, you need to use ultrasound to do this, that's the standard of care, someone might think you're nuts. Whereas today, if you tried to do that without ultrasound, the nurse would run screaming into the room, telling you you're about to harm or potentially kill the patient, and you'd get written up. So adopting new technology and new processes is actually incredibly important to improving quality and safety and, frankly, efficiency.
So you have this broad-based reluctance counterpointed with unique examples and moments along the way here in the past 15, 20 years where technology's benefit has finally been clear to the healthcare community, doctors, nurses, healthcare professionals, and the like. What is it about where we are now that provides both this unique promise for the deployment of more technology and AI, as well as some of the challenges about pulling AI into the system?
So we're actually lucky. We're really lucky because the system is terrible and we're all fed up and pissed off, right? Like if you're a patient, you go to the doctor, you check in, you fill out some paperwork that you already filled out online, then you sit down and you wait, and then the nurse comes and gets you and puts you back in the exam room and weighs you, and then you fill out some more paperwork, and then the nurse asks you some questions, and then eventually the doctor comes in and asks you some questions that you've already answered to the nurse and to the person at the front desk and in the online form. So the patient experience is pretty terrible. The doctor and nursing experience is also pretty terrible. When I was a medical student, someone said it was great that, you know, I was from the West Coast, and I said, why? And they said, well, you probably took typing as a kid because everyone's interested in programming out there, and typing is really important to being a good doctor. And so that's going to make you a much more efficient and better doctor. And I thought, well, what about scientific knowledge, pharmacology, creativity, innovation, bedside manner, forming a bond, being culturally aware? All those things are important. But the professor at the time thought that me being a good typist growing up outside of Seattle was more important than all of that. So, you know, the average internal medicine resident, for example, spends 87% of their day not in patient care. Can you imagine being hospitalized and seeing your doctor for maybe 20, 30 minutes a day? You know, you're in the hospital for heart failure. You're sick enough to be admitted to the hospital. Maybe you're in the hospital for days. Can you see your doctor once a day for a couple minutes?
And why that... Yeah, pretty why that experience. Big imbalance? Why that 87% of the time away from patients?
Because a lot of the processes that we do, so that sort of arc of change that I described in simply driving to the store to visit your friend hasn't happened in healthcare. Yet the number of tasks and things that we have to do has increased. So labor productivity in the hospital industry has been flat or declining on average for every 25 years. So when I went back and looked at this, the Bureau of Labor Statistics publishes these stats every year or every other year. Since I started medical school, hospitals are actually less productive, and the labor in hospitals is less productive than when I started over 15 years later.
Why is that?
So tasks that we should have automated and should have upskilled and offloaded haven't happened. So say you're in the hospital. You have heart failure and you're getting diuresis. We're taking a bunch of water off you because you have 30 pounds of water, and you know they measure your urine output and they measure how much you drink. That's a manual process right now. Like, we literally had to pay someone $10 an hour, and part of their task is to look at the urine collection and then type it and enter it in the computer. Other things like monitoring for arrhythmias, you know, there's a system for it's like telemetry. It monitors your heart rhythm. So there are a couple floors in the hospital I can work on. Again, I work on one of the best hospitals in the country, if not the world. They try and innovate, and they're far ahead of basically, I'd say, the majority of the hospitals in the U.S. On one floor that I work on, the EKGs and the telemetry, you can look at them in the computer, right? So I can log in, I can sit down in my office in the physician charting room on the floor and take a look. On another floor, I can't get that through the electronic health record. I actually have to log into a separate system. And then another floor, that's usually about a 15-minute walk from where the patient area where I usually sit, you can't log into either system and see it. You physically have to walk across the hospital to look at the printed EKG. So
why is that? Is that a hospital administration flaw, or is it a regulatory burden flaw?
So I would say, one, it's a lack of competition in the hospital marketplace, but primarily it's regulatory barriers and risk aversion. So automation and interoperability are things that the FDA is afraid of. So one of my colleagues at the FDA used to joke that they're not worried about cybersecurity because no devices are interoperable. Right? You feel a little better about cybersecurity, but that's also bad because, one, that's not a good cybersecurity strategy. And two, that says a lot about the state of interoperability for technology and medical devices right now.
Is it your contention that FDA then should require every device that can communicate to be able to communicate on a common platform?
No, I think that would increase regulatory burdens. So one of the things that the FDA can and should do is they should use all the tools that they have to encourage partnerships. So the FDA can recognize consensus standards and have that decrease regulatory burdens. You could also have testing in an accredited third-party lab, or it doesn't have to be one lab. It could be multiple labs that manufacturers have choices. So the FCC, for example, which is not historically the pinnacle of regulatory innovation, is actually very good at getting industry together to form a standard developments organization to create standards for various components of the wireless spectrum. So like 802.11b, for example, Bluetooth, et cetera. The FDA could serve a similar role to encourage industry and entrepreneurs to do this, work together, form standards development organizations to encourage interoperability. And that would actually promote the portability of patient data and allow for a decentralized nodal network. So that way the patient and their data are not trapped in any one particular location and they have more freedom of choice. And then data burdens, so data acquisition burdens, could decrease.
Okay, let me just ask you this, because I probably got us... I want to take a step back. I probably leapt ahead to FDA when we should have been concentrating on let's get back to the hospital burden and how the hospital is run. Mm-hmm. So you've got these systems, you've got a tremendous amount of paperwork burden, 87%, I think he said, the time is spent in front of the computer, which is friggin' horrifying. And it always drives me nuts when you go into the hospital with somebody, a family member who's a patient, and the doctor comes in and they're treating the iPad and not the patient. And there's no eye contact. It might as well be a robot mm-hmm. who walks in, and it's just terrible patient care and very dehumanizing. But how would you propose hospitals embrace AI to get that 87% up? And what is this just a, And I guess the question is this a business innovation approach, a patient care innovation approach, or is there a role? We can get to the regulator down the road, but for right now, how should hospitals be viewing AI and harnessing this power?
I think I would actually use all of those frameworks, and that's not to be avoidant. So one is the patient needs to be at the center, because the whole reason that you have the business is for the patient. Right, technology and innovation is there to make things more easily accessible and convenient. So the doctor shouldn't have to spend their time typing. If you could have AI, you know, sitting there with the conversation, and then it transcribes the conversation and puts it into a nice summary, so that way you and the patient can have a conversation about what's going on. You can do your exam, and you're not sitting there at the terminal typing notes about what the patient's telling you. Other things, so display of data and searching for data. We don't have smart dashboards. There's no heads-up display. So if you want to find a lab or you want to find a CT scan report or pull up the images, you have to go searching for it yourself in the patient's chart. And for someone who only has a handful of problems, that's not that hard. But if someone's been chronically ill and has multiple comorbidities and has been to multiple hospitals, searching for that information takes a lot of time. So using AI to sort of key up the information that you're thinking about or that you'll probably need during that visit based upon that conversation could also help improve efficiency. So those are things like directly in the exam room. Then for things, I would say automation of elements of clinical practice. So, you know, doctors want to do the right thing, right? Most doctors want to take care of patients and they want to get people feeling better so that they can go out and enjoy the world, spend time with their family. Imagine if you could, and we have a, you know, shortage of clinical staff from nurses to pharmacists to doctors. Imagine if you could improve the efficiency of that doctor. So if you had, when the radiologist is reading CT scans to look for blood clots, if it automatically teed up sections on the CT scan where it thought there was a blood clot, so the radiologist could focus on those first, and then, of course, go through the rest of the scan. So helping with decision making, be it diagnosis, treatment, prognosis, pattern recognition, it's not going to automate doctors or nurses out of existence, but it will take off some of those tasks and decrease search time. For example, pathology, right? If you have a mole that's removed and it gets sectioned, the pathologist has to look at all the slides. Imagine if, you know, through pattern recognition, through AI, you could automatically identify the areas of suspicion. That would make things much more efficient for the pathologist, might improve their performance of diagnosis. So all of these things will make clinicians more efficient. And at the end of the day, it allows you to see more patients in addition to actually spending the time with the patient. And so for a hospital, one, you'll have happier patients and doctors who are happy because doctors are uniformly unhappy across the country and burned out and depressed because they're not doing the things they went to medical school for. And then as a business, your financial performance will be much better in the long run.
And kind of to your point, when it comes to hospitals and you've laid out opportunities for improvement for doctors, what ultimately will motivate the healthcare community writ large, much less places like hospitals and clinics, to really drive the sort of conversations and development of these options to make them available for healthcare professionals across the country?
So there are a couple things. One is I've long been a believer of change can either happen to you or you can be the change. So I think hospitals will have a choice. And I think that, you know, hospital executives are pretty smart and are going to figure this out and say, I can improve business operations and have happier employees and happier patients and improve my bottom line. Well, this will involve some pain. I need to start looking at this. So I think that's one thing. The other thing is I think the FDA is going to be forced to change how it reviews technology and, in fact, be forced to use some of the technology itself.
Unpack that a little bit, if you could. Explain kind of where FDA's head is right now on technology and what would be the forcing mechanisms, you know, just kind of the reality of the situation, it sounds like, that will require them to rethink how they do their work.
So the device industry has already submitted 500, you know, AI machine learning enabled devices that have been cleared or approved. So the industry is already starting to use software and automation more so in devices. So the FDA is getting more used to this in terms of from device review. For review writ large, as you know, innovative companies start to think about this, you can think about ways to reduce cost. What does reducing cost mean? One, you could change how trials are done or how data are gathered. Imagine if I had a movement disorder like Parkinson's. You could create a disease scale based upon rigidity, standardized gait assessment of someone walking. You could record that. You could automate the scoring of that and correlate that with an expert neurologist opinion. So if you did that, the patient data acquisition could potentially occur in their home in an asynchronous fashion. They wouldn't always have to see a neurologist for every study visit. That could reduce costs. And the FDA will probably, on the drug and device side, start to see new trial designs and new way of gathering data. Then for review, I was a reviewer at the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research. It's a lot of work, right? Your NDA review can be 200 to 300 pages. You have statisticians, pharmacologists, toxicologists. You have pharmacists. You have labeling experts. You have a server that is filled with data and 2,000-page study protocols. You don't need the reviewer and the staff to necessarily do all the basic analyses. We could have AI start and take a first pass at some of the simplest analyses, and then that would free up the reviewer's time to do more complex ways of looking at compiling trial data and finding out the better info about how drugs and devices perform, and potentially shave time off review times.
I got to ask a question here about the FDA. Do you think the FDA is motivated to adopt AI? And why would they do it? I mean, government bureaucrats respond to their incentives just the way we do in the private sector. If you propose this, does it mean fewer reviewers? So some FDA employees get fired. Does it mean more drugs get reviewed and they have just as much work? How do you get FDA to adopt AI tools in order to increase efficiency? And from my perspective, the best goal would be accuracy and speed. You'd want to make sure you don't miss anything, good or ill. Whether you, if you reject a drug that otherwise would work, or for a safety signal that's bogus or delay its approval, and you'd want it to get it approved more quickly than now. Is FDA motivated to adopt AI?
I think it's going to have to be forced. I think that they'll have to have oversight. I think they'll have to have pressure from industry, pressure from the policy community. And then I think most importantly, it's going to have to be part of internal leadership. And what will that mean? One, in some areas, you might need fewer humans. In other areas, you might need more humans. So right now, if you're a product manufacturer, especially if you're a small company and you're developing a product and you're trying to do something different, you might need to talk to the FDA. You might want to have a meeting with them. You might want to get some guidance on trial design. And if you're a reviewer and you have a bunch of INDs, NDAs, and all this stuff flying through, and you have to write these long review documents and do all of these analyses manually, you don't really have time to have a discussion, have that offhand discussion with industry to sort of go through the nuances of trial design or think about ways to reduce costs or different ways to do data assessment or different ways to do patient reported outcomes. So some of those things that I mentioned, reviewers probably know about, but they don't have time to act on. So if we increase the efficiency of review through the use of AI, I think some of those reviewers might have to do other things, but I think a lot of them will actually spend more time working with industry and sharing that knowledge. Because when you are a reviewer, you are literally sitting on top of your therapeutic area. You see everything. right? So a company spends $1 billion in a decade on a development program, and then it ends up on the server, and then you're sitting at your desk waiting through it. So if you do that for 5 or 10 years, there's a lot of things you know that, frankly, no one else is necessarily going to know. And so the reviewer actually can then be a guide to pharmaceutical product developers and help them have more efficient trials and get better information about safety and efficacy and do so in a more efficient and shorter fashion. But it's going to require
Is there a way that that transparency and what's going on in industry writ large could be pushed out into the public and be available for the developers as well? So for instance, you've got a reviewer that's been doing this for 10 years and their accumulated experience, the studies they've seen, the companies they've come in that have failed with X molecule or Y molecule and the successes. They're seeing all this stuff, some of which is proprietary, right? Some of this data over time is proprietary. Is there some way that that data can be compiled in a useful fashion so that a developer doesn't waste time trying to develop in a certain mechanism of action, which you as the reviewer may be like, this thing is never going to work. And I know why, but maybe the data I had seen was proprietary and I can't share that, or you just are not in communication with the company. And you have no idea that they're working on this development program anyway. But you have knowledge that if they had, they would save themselves $1 billion in 5-6 years of development before this thing blew up, or maybe 10 years.
And I think the important thing to note about saving $1 billion or saving 5 or 6 years is that for that pharmaceutical company, that time and those funding and human capital hours will then be spent developing another product. So, and that's, I think, an important thing that people often don't realize is they think if you save a pharma company money, you're saving a pharma company money. You're saving a pharma company money to then work on their next line of development for therapeutics for patients. So what does this mean for the reviewer who, as I said, sits on top and sees everything? I'm a big fan that they need to get out there, right? You can't live in your office. If you're living in your office, you're not sharing knowledge and helping guide people. And you're right that the reviewer can't say, oh, I read this trial 2 years ago, which showed X. They can't say that, but they can still give decentralized, non-identifiable guidance. So for example, when I was at the FDA, one of the things that we started, finally published, took a couple years, was a patient-level analysis of all pre-market antidepressant trials submitted to the FDA from 1979 to 2016, right? Only the FDA has that data. There's no university that has that data to do that analysis. So one, the FDA needs to do more things like that. And with that increased time, the reviewers can do that. The other thing they need to do is be going out to meetings, you know, going to the ASCO meeting, going to various scientific meetings. The reviewers need to be sort of an emissary for development and innovation within their therapeutic area. And I think the other thing they need to do, and we should think about doing, is having reviewers be part-time clinicians. Because I can tell you, when you're at the bedside and someone doesn't have therapeutic options, or they're screaming at you about something because they're unhappy, that's a great way to hold your feet to the fire and keep you realistic about what a realistic outcome is and about what the need for innovation is. So I think, technology will allow for reviewers to be more efficient, which will allow them to be better guides to industry, especially small companies, hopefully create time for part-time clinical practice, and then also allow them to engage the broader scientific and clinical community.
Brian, we've talked a lot about, and you've explained a lot about potential opportunities here for improving the quality of care for patients, opportunities for doctors and people who are committed to healthcare to really be able to produce on behalf of patients and everybody inside the system. But as you know, there are a fair number of criticisms and concerns about AI generally, as well as specifically when it comes to its potential application in healthcare, from apprehension about its use somehow keeping doctors and other healthcare professionals away from diagnoses and interaction with patients, to things such as how algorithms are built, how data is abstracted and put in front of people, and the commercial bias that might creep in here. Have you thought a little bit about that? Can you address some of those concerns for people as they're continuing to think about hearing about healthcare and AI potentiality and thinking about its application, either, as Joe says, through their own personal experience or anecdotally, or just generally their attitude and experiences in the past about the healthcare system?
So this is a general scientific problem. If I test a pharmaceutical product or device and I test it in a trial that's entirely women, and assuming the study is internally valid, from external generalizability of that clinical trial, I can say, well, this works in this population of women. Not sure, you know, if it'll necessarily work in men, depends upon the pharmacology and physiology of the specific question. That's always been a question in science. It's the same thing about AI. If you design AI on a data and train it based upon a data set that doesn't have a diverse population, or is a population that doesn't look like the population that you applied in, there's the question of whether that tool is generalizable and valid. That's a data problem that can be solved. So I'm actually pretty optimistic that the concerns about bias and generalizability and validity can be addressed. But we have to be pragmatic and realistic about it. It's not really policy or a political problem. It's just pragmatic and thoughtful scientific thinking.
So, right. Do you have I'm sorry. I mean, it's just sort of fascinating to me that it is viewed as a political problem, as if people are out there purposely building algorithms in order to be discriminatory. Now, we apparently see evidence of that, ironically, from Google and Gemini, who are bending over backwards to be woke, that they can't show, when you ask them to show a picture of a founding father, and they show women, you ask them to show pictures of Nazis, and they show people who are from Asia. They're doing this to be PC and writing that purposefully, but it doesn't seem like if you're and they're purporting to be so woke and everything, which is leading to the inaccuracy. The question is, why would a medical device manufacturer or somebody developing an AI tool want their results to be biased?
And that's a really good point that I don't think I've ever heard anyone make, which is that the medical device manufacturer or the software programmer designing a healthcare tool for a healthcare setting wants to ensure that the result is accurate. They want to ensure that the result is precise, and they want to assure that their model is valid for the population it's being used in. So I would say all of the incentives for anyone who's developing healthcare products in this space are such that you, as the developer, are going to try and do the right thing. Because if you don't do the right thing and your model turns out to be wrong, you could be liable. You could be sued. You could be sued by the doctors. You could be sued by the hospital. You could be sued by the patients. You could be subject to a class action lawsuit. So I think that the incentives are such that people are going to hopefully be very thoughtful about designing things so that they are not discriminatory.
Brian, one of the healthcare epics of our modern era was the penetration of the HMO model, starting out on the West Coast and moving throughout the entire United States. And a lot of criticism of that throughout the 1990s as it became the predominant way of delivering healthcare for Americans was a concern that this model was designed expressly to reduce costs and therefore have a significant impact on the quality and availability of care for patients. We've talked a little bit about some of the potentiality for savings for the system as AI is developed, but is AI's potentiality for savings and cost implications the predominant reason why so many people in the health industry are really intrigued with the possibility of AI right now?
I think so. I view it, though, as one of many choices. I think, like, so I flew to Stanford like a month or so ago to go visit and give a talk and meet some people. It's a 5-hour and 50-minute flight. The pilot was not white-knuckling it the entire time there on the commercial airliner. He or she had autopilot, and they had to take control to avoid some turbulence. That's automation. They clearly were doing other tasks. I don't think they were asleep, right? There are other things they have to do to maintain a safe flight. I think that automation is going to increase efficiency, could reduce costs, but it will also improve quality and safety. And I think that's the thing people haven't realized. And the thing that they really haven't realized is the unmet medical need. And you say, oh God, what does unmet medical need mean?
Took the words right out of my mouth.
It's not a political thing. It's not a policy thing. It's just pragmatic. So, you know, we have care guidelines about what people are supposed to do. I'm an internist in the hospital, right? But my counterpart, the internist outside the hospital, the poor primary care doc, filling out prior authorizations, returning phone calls, reading faxes. Yes, the fax machine lobby is alive and well. If they do everything they're supposed to do, they follow all the guidelines for all their patients and do order all the clinical preventive services, their average workday will be 27 hours. So there are not 27 hours in the day, and it's not really realistic for them to even work 18 hours in a day. So there are all kinds of clinical preventive services and things that are not getting done, and that's just in primary care. So anything we can do to increase efficiency, increase precision, increase accuracy, reduce costs, make labor more productive is going to help the delivery system meet that massive unmet medical need that is out there and also free up people to actually spend time with their clinicians. So if you think about it, if we go to a more extreme example, which is a ways away, and we say that, you know, AI could help suggest treatments for cancer, the natural response is, well, the oncologist is threatened by that. Not necessarily, because when you have cancer, you don't know what you're going to, like, you have no idea what's going to happen to you and how your life is going to change, what surgeries and procedures you're going to need, what side effects you're going to have, what it means for your functional status, all kinds of other things. The oncologist is the best person to talk with you about that most of the time. But if the oncologist is spending time, you know, sorting through hundreds of articles or thousands of articles that have been published in the past year, they don't have that much time to have that conversation with you. So it will allow clinicians to return to being a counselor and partner to their patients instead of a data sorter.
Let me go to this incentives, though. I mean, do the hospitals really have economic incentive? You mentioned they lack competition, right? They can charge whatever they want. Mm-hmm. They get reimbursed from the federal pay schedule and what the insurance companies will pay. There's no bonus for being more efficient. They don't. It's not like going to McDonald's, where if it took you an hour and 45 minutes to get your hamburger, you would leave and not go back to that McDonald's, right? You're a patient, you're sick, there's a hospital that's close to you, you got to go to that.
One McDonald's.
Right. If there was only one McDonald's within 300 miles, actually, one burger joint, right? Because in many places, you're prohibited for certificate of need laws to set up competitive businesses to the hospital, right? Mm-hmm. So what is the... I get it. I get what you're saying, that the doctor is going to be happier. He's going to be more efficient. He's not going to be as burnout. Does the hospital care? really about you guys? I mean, it seems to me it's so obvious, and I've been hearing about administrative burden and paperwork among doctors for years, and some of these things are obvious. It has been obvious to me going to fill out the three sets of paperwork that you said for years that they don't care that much. And when you show up and like, oh, did you bring your records? I'm like, no, I didn't bring my records. They told me they were going to be sent over to you. They didn't send them over. Mm-hmm. And like, no, we don't have your records. You're going to have to come back another. There's something in lack of motivation that I don't quite grasp, except for the fact that the customer is not paying the bill and has nowhere else to go.
So a couple things. One is there's social media. So patients can put a lot of pressure on hospitals now that they probably couldn't have done 10 or 15 years ago. So that's item number one. Patients have more ways to increase pressure. I think the other thing people are realizing is that doctors and nurses are really fed up. And you're like, oh, I've heard about this for 20 years that doctors and nurses are fed up. But doctors and nurses can now go do other things and not practice medicine and go work for McKinsey. As an example, and that's not to knock McKinsey.
You can knock McKinsey. Go ahead and knock McKinsey. That's perfectly acceptable.
People have other options for jobs that they can do with their knowledge. So that technical knowledge is getting ported in something like a half of graduating medical students are less interested or not interested in practicing medicine. So that creates a real problem for hospitals because if they don't have doctors and nurses and pharmacists to hire, they're going to be forced to use tech tools to make the ones that they have more efficient in order to meet demand. So, and what does this mean? Like the burnout's actually at a point where when I was a resident, one of my colleagues had a spreadsheet open. I asked them what they were doing and they said they were planning their retirement and seeing how much money they had to save in order to retire by age 45.
Oh,
so if that's already happening, that means that pressure is reaching the boiling point. I think the other thing.
Sorry, no. Keep going.
The other thing is the transition, and I'm going to use some gobbledygook, so I apologize. From volume to value, but let's actually put some.
Don't
meat
talk
on that
about volume and value. That's all nonsense.
Wait.
Value is the value trap. The value trap. It's nonsensical.
Hey, Joe, let the three listeners who care about this. Listen to Brian talk about it.
But taking that gobbledygook and making it meaningful, it's risk-adjusted capitation or population-based payment. So that's rather than going from fee-for-service to a population-based payment, that's half of Medicare and three-quarters of Medicaid. And I realize that there are problems with both of those programs and lots of opportunities for improvement on policy and capitation rates and risk adjustment. But the feature is that there will eventually be a budgeting framework for those programs. And when there's a budgeting framework for those programs, that will put financing pressure on the delivery system. And we actually just saw this in the last year or so when Medicare Advantage hit around 51% of the marketplace. And everyone started getting very interested and very concerned about its impact on hospitals. And the hospitals started getting upset. Now, it's not that the hospitals don't have valid concerns. They do have many valid concerns. But it's primarily a change in their financing structure and negotiating. So it changes those incentives. And the delivery system, which, as you said, Joe, hasn't experienced this pressure for a long time, is just starting to get it.
So capitation, and maybe we'll have you back to talk about that and value, because this is something that's been going on with MIPS and MACRA and ACOs and, mm-hmm. and frankly, a lot of fantasy accounting and nonsense for many years.
Absolutely.
But I want to ask you a question. As a physician, could you see mm-hmm. a scenario where you were recruited from the University of to the University of Maryland or to some new hospital that perhaps was physician owned, which is currently prohibited in mm-hmm. in statute, and University of Maryland said, we have adopted AI tools So you are not going to be spending 87% of your time doing paperwork. You're going to be spending 56% of your time on paperwork. The rest of the time, you're going to be patient. There's only one hiccup. You're going to take a 5% haircut. Or the physician-owned hospital recruits you and says, hey, look, we have AI tools, an entirely different administrative model. We are built, everything is built around the patient and the physician. You are going to make 20% less in salary. You'll have some type of ownership in the system, and you will spend a lot more time with the patient, 80% with the patient, 20% doing paperwork. Can you see a scenario where you would take that, either one of those deals?
Absolutely. The main reason doctors are switching jobs is it's not really if you're going to give someone a little bit more money. It's mainly the support around you. So do you have good administrative support? Does your clinic work well? If you're a proceduralist, does your procedure suite, like, and are your staff, do you have all the supplies? Is the turnover quick? If you're a surgeon, is the operating room turned over efficiently? Do you have to do all this documentation? It's all about process and pain. And so those are huge motivating factors for physicians to change their employer. So I'd say absolutely.
And yes. Do you think if physician-owned, you've written about physician-owned hospitals, I know this is a subject mm-hmm. of passion for you. Do you think, is this because you're just a greedy bastard and you want to get involved in the physician-owned hospital game? Or do you think that there is an opportunity for physicians to take control over this aspect of care delivery and model hospitals in a physician image as opposed to a bureaucratic or accountant's image?
I mean, I'm an academic hospital medicine physician at an elite university. So by definition, I'm one of the lowest paid hospitalists in the country. So I'm definitely not a greedy bastard. I would say it's the innovation focus, right? So, you know, having the person, and that's one of the reasons I continue to practice in addition to doing policy, is I think it's really important to be on the front line and see how things work and don't work and see how, for example, a lot of that payment policy stuff, as you said, is fantasy accounting, meaningless gobbledygook when you actually get into the exam room or the hospital with the patient. So having people who are doing the work, helping design the process and operations, makes a lot of sense to me.
Well, Brian, I think that puts a great exclamation point on this conversation with you. And I want to really appreciate and thank you for being on the podcast today. Remember, everybody, call your attention to the articles that Joe talked about, written by Brian earlier, An Innovation-Driven Future for the Food and Drug Administration and Using Artificial Intelligence to Improve Administrative Process in Medicaid. Brian will also be leading a panel for the American Enterprise Institute, AEI, on July 10th on health policy in the 2024 election, which we will get you back to have a conversation about down the line. We'd like to thank our sponsor for DCEKG, Survivors for Solutions, our executive producer, John C.Z. Swartacki, our producer, Lauren Timmerman, and our distribution partner, Big Wig Media, and our production team, Evergreen. On behalf of DCEKG, this is Eric Euland, along with host Joe Grogan. Thanks for listening. We'll be talking.
This has been DCEKG. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss the next episode. While you're at it, leave us a rating and review to help others find out about the show.